Welcome back, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 13th of February, 2012, and I am back from my week-long trip to Beijing, China, where I was putting together some interviews for a forthcoming documentary for GRTV, so look for that to start coming out later this month. But in the meantime, of course, it is Monday, so once again, we're back with our old friend Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster. So Bob, it's great to have you back on the program tonight, and it's been 2 weeks since we last talked, so I'm sure a lot of stuff has taken place in my absence, and I haven't been following the news as closely as possible because I was a bit disconnected behind the lines in communist China. So I don't know what's on your radar tonight, but anywhere you want to start, let's take it from there.
Well, do the communists in China act like communists?
I would say not the way you would think communists would act. But again, what does that even mean?
Well, I'm just thinking, is their mindset to a business like you would find in Western nations, or is it different?
I think that they are the most business and money-oriented people on the planet, or at least among them, and they've definitely got some business plans up their sleeves.
Well, they definitely are buying lots of gold and silver, I'll tell you that. And you know that, I think it's called the Hong Kong Merc. It's going to open up in, I think it's July 1st. That means that, and they're going to sell bars like you would contract for on the COMEX and other exchanges, the LBMA in London. And if they do that, there's not much sense in somebody in China making a contract to take delivery of a silver bar, say in September, when they can do it at the Hong Kong Exchange and get fast delivery, and or if they want to buy the cash, they can do that as well. I think it's going to make up a real basis to a change in how Asia does business in gold and silver. And I think that will affect not only China and Hong Kong, but Japan and Singapore, Malaysia, and other countries that have a large interest in gold and silver. So I thought I kind of threw that in there.
Well, that is interesting because it also seems to be part of the greater decoupling of the entire world structure from the old U.S. dollar hegemony that's going on in so many different facets. And of course, we've seen that with Iran being sort of put behind bars, so to speak, with the EU sanctions on its oil, etc. But instead, they're really just cutting deals with India to do exchanges in local currency and in wheat and other commodities instead of through the dollar system. And then we see China and Japan, for example. I believe they've just signed a new pact to do more direct yuan-yen changes. So, I mean, we see that decoupling happening in so many places. It really seems that the old petrodollar hegemony is starting to fall apart at the seams.
Well, from my point of view, I have to figure out, if I can, whether this is being done deliberately or it's being done against the will, let us call it the United States government. And I think the latter is the case. And you've got the BRIC nations out there and others who are sick and tired of taking losses in dollars, and they would like multiple currencies or some other alternative that preferably would be based on gold, and that's why those countries have been buying gold and probably will continue to be, because I think they're looking to back a currency with 20% gold. It's only a guess, but I'm usually pretty close on this. Now, dealing with the situation regarding Iran, coming full circle to the beginning of this question. Is it the insiders doing this deliberately, or is Iran acting in concert?
Brick force, we'll call it.
Your audio just kind of cut out there.
I know.
Okay.
Sorry.
No problem.
It's my fault. And so what is the answer? I think it's the latter. I think there's a move to forcibly make the U.S. government, the U.S. dollar, no longer the only reserve currency in the world. And Iraq tried that, and Saddam Hussein got hung for it. He was no angel, but he didn't deserve that. As you said, India and Iran are discussing payment. The only thing holding up that payment is the laws regarding taxes in India. And they would have to pass some legislation which would allow them to be able to bypass this tax that they have. And I don't remember exactly how it works, but I'm trying to recall. But anyway, that's the gist of the situation. And, you know, India spends about $12 billion a year on Iranian oil, which is 12% of their imports. So what they want to do is, in some part, exchange some gold and the remainder in rupees. I imagine that India might be fortunate to be able to pay for 25% in gold and 75% in rupees. And the rupees are going to be, part of that deal, the rupees are going to be spent by Iran in India. So it would be a balanced trade, more or less. So that's a very, very clear indication of what Iran, China, India, Russia, Brazil, Venezuela, and perhaps others are up to. They want an alternative or a different reserve currency for the world, whatever it may be. And I think this is really at the seat of the whole problem. The deal was made in 1971 with the oil-producing nations in the Middle East was this, very simply. We made it, well, the British made a deal with them in 1920-22. And the deal is we'll protect you, and you pump the oil, you pump it in dollars, and all of the money that's left over after expenses and what you need comes to us and we manage it. And that's the deal that's been out there for a long time. And that kind of a deal, if broken, would cause real problems for oil producers who are only dealing in dollars. They'd have to start, well, they don't have to, but they probably would start to shift to other currencies as well, and that would bring down the petrodollar. And this is what this is all about. There's a lot of other reasons, too. Don't get me wrong. It's the third largest oil producer in the world. They like to steal that oil like they did in Iraq, and all of the oil that's under the ground in Afghanistan that nobody ever talks about, that everybody's known about for 130 years. So anyway, I think that's where that's going. I think they would want to attack Iran in the future, not now. The little to-do you just saw over the last couple of months to me was very simply a game, and they were trying to distract people from the problems in Europe, just like they distract people from the problems in Europe by knocking down commodities, and particularly gold and silver, and holding it down. And so that's the game that they're playing there. But I don't think that the U.S. is capable logistically, even though they get surrounding bases, you know, around Syria and Iran, and they wouldn't be ready for at least a year to 2 years. There's all kinds of things you got to do. And you got to remember the $1 trillion a year that is being spent on Vietnam, excuse me, in Iran, on Afghanistan and Iraq is off budget. So government doesn't care how much money they spent. I mean, to them, it just went into a black hole, and maybe somebody might pay it back someday. And so I think that's the direction in relation to Iran. And the longer the U.S. takes, the stronger they're going to get.
They meaning Iran?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think...
And the other nations involved. Because, you know, if there's a world pullback, everybody's going to suffer. I mean, the bad ones, the tens, are going to be Europe, the U.S., and England. And that'll be followed by, say, the fives. And that'll be China, Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, Canada. They'll probably get hurt half as badly.
I think you're right. Ultimately, I do see a lot of the testing of the waters, so to speak, that took place between Iran and America recently as sort of the long-term buildup to the tensions. And now that that moment has passed, I really do see it as just another part of the long-term buildup rather than the kickoff to the actual intervention, which I would imagine would probably take place after Syria anyways, depending on what happens in Syria now. So I tend to agree. I think that the moment of extreme tension between Iran and America was more for the optics and for the testing of the waters than for the actual launching of an attack. Of course, it does leave open the possibility that the intervention could happen at any moment, and it always depends on what type of event they might stage or provocateur or whatever it may be in the Strait of Hormuz and other tense areas like that. But let's turn to more domestic matters for those in the U.S. right now. Something that happened while I was away was the idea of this foreclosure settlement that they're now talking about, the foreclosure gate, apparently, becoming to its denouement. And it's been reported on in quite a wide variety of media, but even Time.com recently came out with this headline: "Is the $25 billion foreclosure settlement a stealth bank bailout?" And it says Thursday's $25 billion foreclosure settlement received praise from some consumer groups, but the reaction was not all positive. One detail of the deal that has raised questions and concerns is reports that the five major U.S. banks will get credit for principal reduction of mortgages they do not own. While the fine print of the plan has yet to be released, mortgage investors fear they will be forced to write down the value of their holdings. And I suppose a less diplomatic approach was taken by blogforarizona.com, which had the headline, "Foreclosure Gate Update, The Banksters of Wall Street Win Again." This one seems to be an absolute slap in the face to the American public yet again, with the banksters walking off with trillions of dollars in benefits and being forced to pay a paltry $25 billion in remunerations, most of which really won't go to the mortgage holders themselves. It seems on its face to be quite ridiculous. But Bob, I'd be interested to hear your take on this.
Well, the AGs for the state sold out from the beginning. All they want is the cash flow so they can offset the deficits they've got. They could give a fiddler's flying you-know-what in regard to the average person and how he lost or she lost so much on their home. I think that though that group of banks defrauded the American public of about $3 trillion. And I've written about this all over the past year as they negotiated. And the bottom line is they're paying about 8 cents on the dollar that they stole. They're giving 8 cents back. And it's highway robbery. It's dreadful. It's an insult, particularly to professionals. I mean, they've got to understand what's going on. And, you know, they just shrug their shoulders and go on and say, well, I guess they can do what they want to do. And, of course, that is true. But here in America, it is a very, very important thing that people understand what they're doing. And most people don't know. All I know is there's been a mortgage settlement for $25 million. They don't know what the top numbers are. And they don't know that they're getting away for 8 cents on the dollar stolen. I mean, nobody's going to jail. I mean, they have these rules that protect all these criminals. And I don't know what's going to make Americans work. Do something about it. Get involved. Say, I've had enough. And, you know, the crime in the banking community is so endemic. It's so systemic that even a lot of professionals don't understand what they're up to because they don't know that the Federal Reserve is privately owned. And even if you tell them, they say, oh, it can't be. It's not. No, it isn't. You're wrong. And, of course, we're not wrong. We have the secret to how they steal. But then again, maybe we should set up a parallel system, steal more than they do, and put them out of business or something like that. But anyway, no, that's facetious. The point is they've gotten away with it. And you see these different scandals. I remember a few years ago, all these corporations were backdating their options to lower prices of execution, and they got caught falsifying it. Now, there were about 700 offices of corporations. They're all major corporations stealing from the American public, and that's what that is. It's stealing. And one of them went to jail. He got a year and a half for falsifying out of 700. And why did he go to jail? Because he wasn't connected. He wasn't one of them. And look at MF. MF Global. 1.6, now there's a new figure out. $1.6 trillion stolen. And nobody can find it. Give me a break. Anybody who's taken accounting one at university can find it. And all of these rock stars of finance can't find it. You got to be kidding me. They stole it. Now the question is, how much will the clients get back? I've seen settlements already where participants with accounts, and these are margin accounts, are told, you take 60% of what you had in there and shut your mouth and we'll give you anything. You'll end up with the general creditors and we don't think they're going to get anything. Now, that's interesting. Very interesting. And I did correspond with one who got 70% back. What they did is they just neutralized the positions that they had on. And if they had profits in them, they get screwed out of them. And it's as simple as that. But the money's stolen. I mean, these capers go on all the time. I released the information on Madoff 3 weeks before the story broke. And what it did do in the media industry brought me a couple of good friends who were editors of newspapers who said, you're right on. And we've been in touch ever since. But the point is this. the reason that they had trials, well, I guess it just really had one, a hearing and then a trial. Nobody was invited except the attorneys, the bailiff, and the judge. Now, why did they do that? They did it from what I said it was from the very beginning. It looked like Nugent Hand all over again. And for those of you not yet young, too young to remember, during the 80s, the CIA started up a sting in Asia. And the sting was against American military personnel for the most part. And as it turned out, one of the gentlemen involved shot himself in the back of the head, and the other one went to a federal penitentiary in Hawaii for, I think, 15 years. He's probably out now. Maybe he's dead for all I know. They have a way of dying in prison, these people who know too much. But it had all the earmarks of that. This was a CIA Mossad scam operation. And that's why there was no trial. They didn't want any discovery. And that's why I was able to find out ahead of time. And the government's not very happy about that. But anyway, I'm getting too old to worry about what the government thinks. Anyway, go ahead, Jim.
Well, I think you're exactly right to bring it back to some of those scandals from the past, like the Nugent Hand Bank and some of the other things that have come out in the past. But I think the difference that we find ourselves in the current political climate is that these types of just brazen, in-your-face stealing and plundering of more and more incalculable sums from Madoff to MF Global to the foreclosure gate scandal, the fact that these scams just seem to keep getting bigger and bolder and more in your face, and the penalties are so laughable in comparison, it almost makes me feel like we're in a snowball process where the snowball keeps gaining and gaining steam and getting bigger as it goes down the hill. And to me, it almost seems like the entire society becomes part of that snowball process, so that the message to people, even people who would never think of really doing this in the first place or perpetrating some sort of scam, the message is just think big and scam people in a big way, and there will be no real serious repercussions. And that to me seems like it's a type of feedback effect where it'll just keep getting larger and larger. And as we've seen so many times throughout history, the elites, once they get to that stage of the growing snowball of plunder, it doesn't stop until the entire system falls apart. And that seems to me the precipice that we're going over right now. But I'd be interested to get your take on that.
Well, this goes back to the late 70s, and I wrote about it a little bit in Wednesday's issue that's coming out. And this started in its current form in the late 70s with the CIA and others, the Mossad, in setting up these phony baloney wars for independence and all that kind of stuff. And then there was Al-Qaeda and Taliban, which are owned by the CIA as well. And so what it evolved into was an institutionalized form of stealing. And when I get really deeply involved in it, and, you know, God knows if I'd ever been recruited in the early 60s by the CIA, I probably would have been into it up to my eyeballs, because I wouldn't have been able, as an employee, to avoid it. And so with that said, they started these contraband operations, if you may. And I hate to tell you this, but there's been thousands of them. And all of these politicians, bureaucrats, hanger-ons, and then, of course, the people from Wall Street and Washington, they're all involved in it. All of them. There's probably some that aren't. Maybe 5%. 7%, and that's it. And that includes campaign contributions, all that other stuff that goes along with it. And so it's just going to get worse, as you said. There's no control. They are control. They do what they want to do. And you've got nothing to say about it. It's just like that new law that says the president can have you picked up. Well, I don't know if they're willing to pick up an old man in his late 70s, but the point is that they're doing what they want to do. And don't open your mouth. Look what's happened to all the whistleblowers. Most of them have been dealt with unfairly, terribly unfairly. And I won't list them all because I don't know all their names. There's some prominent ones. And they didn't do it for money. They did it because they were good, decent people who didn't want to see the system being used the way that it was by a gang of crooks who run around in $6,000 suits. I mean, even in the Beltway today, they wear $2,000 suits. And these guys are making $150,000-$200,000 a year for doing virtually nothing. They might think it's important, but I don't. And so there's lots and lots of this going on. It has a long history. What really flipped me on the switch on this for me was back, I think it was in 84, and I was talking to Ollie North. And he said something about Al-Qaeda and this Osama bin Laden. And that was the first time I ever heard the name. And I said, who's that? Oh, he's a terrorist and he's bad. And it clicked. I knew exactly then what they were up to. And I talked to Ollie a couple of times during the ensuing years, probably into the early 1990s, 91, 92. And that was it. But that's what they were up to, stealing. And they have a war for a cover and so on and so forth. And you don't want to know how I know Ollie North.
I must admit, if I had the chance to talk to him, I'd have probably some choice words to say to him about his service to his country.
I'll tell you a funny story. I walked in his office the first time, and he's got this file on his desk, and I looked at it, and I smiled, and he smiled. He said, you should be one of us, you know. I said, did you have fun reading my CIA file? And he said, yeah. He says, you're a good guy. I said, well, gee, thank you very much. But I don't know exactly how to take you at this point. I said, but for your information, I did read a book called Compromised. And you're featured prominently in that book, as you probably know. And he said, well, let's get on to some other business. Didn't want to talk about it.
I can't imagine why.
And there's a lot more to that you'll never hear, because they really will come out and get me.
Well, I won't press you on it, but absolutely, very, very telling, I think, certainly of someone who was very much in the thick of things in the 80s there and telegraphing the whole bin Laden Al-Qaeda story even back at that time.
It's like a spider web. You know, almost everybody's involved. And if you're not involved, you're a nudnik or a dope or, you know, what are you thinking about? We're all making millions and millions of dollars and you're standing there on principle? I mean, that's really what it amounts to. I mean, it's like Ron Paul today. Let's tell the truth. Well, there are some people who are interested, But most really aren't. And even if they are, they're afraid. They're terrified to open their mouths up.
That is unfortunately the case. So the question obviously becomes, how do we transition from a society where people are afraid to speak up or stand up against the undoubted abuses that are going on to a society that's more based on the principles that we want to see?
Well, you have to take control of your society away from the criminals. And that's the bankers in Wall Street. And you do that through the ballot box. And if all the elections are fixed and you can't do anything about it, like we just saw in, I don't know, six elections, primaries for the Republican nomination, you get mad enough, you have a revolution. It's pretty simple.
It certainly is, and that's why I think, once again, it would behoove people to check into the history of how such things as the War for Independence came about, and the lead-up to that, and what the Founding Fathers were doing in that period before, and how they motivated at least a significant percentage of that society to get involved, or at least the significant percentage that gets involved in such things when most of the population just goes along to get along. But again, it only takes a few percent to really fundamentally alter a society.
Well, it was 3 to 5% in the revolution, and 60% of the inhabitants of the colonies were pro-British. I mean, they prominently displayed their flags in front of their businesses, and nothing ever really happened to them because of it. Some of them went back to England, but not many. And so there were many people who were on the other side. But you can make it happen, particularly in a society that has weapons. And in this case, we don't have a occupational army yet. We have an army. We have our services. And I very, very seriously dispute whether, under major circumstances, that they'll act against the public. If they're told to, I would think that there might very well be a coup. And that's the best and easiest way for Americans to get out of this mess. Because once you bring the banking system down, it's a key, it's a heart of the control of the American people and the people of the world, for that matter. And that's very, very important, because once their control mechanism is gone, the fractional banking system, they're screwed.
Well, let's turn to slightly more prosaic, but perhaps more relevant matters to a lot of people out there, and let's look at the job market at the moment. And I note that in the recent edition of The Forecaster, you have some stories that seem contradictory on the surface, one about PepsiCo planning to cut about 3% of its workforce, or 8,700 jobs. Although it says that also there's a story in the Forecaster, the number of Americans filing new applications for unemployment benefits unexpectedly fell last week, suggesting recent gains in employment are being sustained. And that's the dominant narrative at this time, that unemployment is going down slowly but surely. And that, but something that really stuck out for me is a recent post on the Economic Collapse blog under the headline, "Why Are Record Numbers of Young Adults Jobless and Living at Home with Mom and Dad?" which paints a very different story of where the economy is at. And it has this startling statistic that the employment rate for Americans between the ages of 18 and 24 is 54.3%. That's the employment rate, is 54.3% for Americans 18 to 24, down from 62.4% just 5 years ago in 2007. So let's see about that title of that article. Bob, why are record numbers of young adults jobless and living at home with mom and dad in this increasingly decrepit and decapitated economy?
The low-paying jobs have been taken by illegal aliens. There's 15 million of them in the economy. And because they have been forced to take lower wages, usually off the books, instead of getting, say, $10 an hour, they probably get $7. And it's more preferred for an employer to take the chance of putting 20 of them or 200 of them on the books, because you can save a lot of money. And if he gets in trouble, his congressman will sort it out anyway. And so those are the jobs, that the entry-level jobs that young people would get. And, of course, those entry-level jobs, say, for college graduates in accounting, in this day and age, could come in about $25,000 a year. Most of those jobs are not available because companies, particularly large companies, have cut back on employment. On employment. And the reason I've done so is increase the bottom line. What they're running into is a different story. I'll get to later. But I think they, most of them have laid off just about as many people as they can. And that would include not just the entry-level worker, but also the college graduate. They can get things done in China and Pakistan and other places for one-tenth to 30% of the costs that they would pay for the same job in the United States. So they're not hiring those just out of college or newly out of college people. Now, it's not only them. I mean, there's people, I mean, anybody over 40, try and get a job. They don't want you. And then we get this new Obama medical bill coming up. I mean, I cringe to think. I mean, you get sick, you're screwed unless you pay for it yourself. And that's what it's going to come down to. If you don't have the money, you die. I mean, you come up before the death panel and they say, Mr. Chapman, now you got a bad heart, you got prostate problems, you got flat feet, crossed eyes. I mean, that's going to cost us, and you're diabetic. Now, that's going to cost us $250,000 a year. You probably live another 10 years. And we're not willing to spend $2.5 million on you. Adios. And you die. That's the way it works. So, but getting back, they don't want to commit themselves, the employer, to new hires because they're roped into this new legislation unless it's changed. There is a chance of change next year. If the president is defeated and the House goes Republican, as well as the Senate. And so the possibilities are there, but they're a long shot. And so employers don't want to commit themselves. Last fall, the banking community put the word out, we're going to start making loans. During the course of the second half of the year, they increased loans by 10%. And they're in the process, they, the banks, of increasing them a bit more. Probably the increase has come about 20-25%. And that will go to small and medium-sized businesses, and that is an indirect result of QE3, which will be taking bonds off the hands of banks that are worthless, or nearly so, and the slosh over from all the money that's going to be spent in Europe. They've been allocated $1 trillion for openers. The banks, 523 banks in trouble. Can you believe that? And so between the two of them, we're going to have a 1.5% the 2% growth rate in the United States this year. And everybody says, wow, gee, look at it. Everything's terrible. Blah, 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 blah. Well, they're right. But there's going to be enough money to carry this thing for about a year and a half. A year and a half. Maybe more. And so this fatal vision is not going to jump up in your face right away. It's coming. Just be patient. The longer it takes, the less painless it is now, which is really terrific for you because you don't lose your home and starve to death. But that's the direction they're headed. They committed themselves. And in that commitment, the only one that they could make, the bankers, is we got to print until hell freezes over. And they know that's the only way out for them.
Not much of an out, unfortunately. Not one that leaves the general public in a better position. But we're running out of time here, so just wrapping up, I know that there are a number of young college-age students that listen to this program and that correspond with me. What advice would you have for someone of that age right now who's facing these monumental unemployment numbers for that age group and the problems that you detail trying to get some starter-level jobs? What kinds of advice would you give to people facing that situation?
Well, let's say you want to be an accountant and you've trained for it and all the companies are not hiring accountants. So what you do is you go to a company and take any job that they've got and say you want to work your way up and that you'd like to be an accountant and that's what you're shooting for. And so if there's an opening a year and a half from now, I get it. Is that a deal? And I think most employers will go for that because they know that this guy's been doing some crummy job for them, say for a year or so, and he's done very well in a job that he's more highly qualified for. And that's a way to do it. I've known people who've gone in and worked for nothing just to get an opportunity like that. In advertising, Madison Avenue, forget it. It's interconnected business. Stock market, it's good. There's a lot more barriers than there used to be. You can make a lot of money being a stock broker. I made millions. And so that endeavor for people who are bright, quick, and you've all... If you're taking business courses, you've had finance and economics. Not that it did you a lot of good, but anyway, you took it, like I did, and then had to relearn it later. That's another way. In interviews, be different. Say, you know, the vision all my life was to work for Disney and be in production. And that's what I did in college. And you tell me there's no openings. How about if I work for 6 months for no pay just for you to see what I can do? So you got to be innovative. I mean, it's just like you're in a battle and getting shot at. You know, how do we take the enemy out? Innovation. Being aggressive. Not lying there and taking no for an answer or getting shot for an answer. So
absolutely.
Those are important things.
I agreed completely. I think those are some very good points and salient points. But of course, another important part of being equipped and ready for today's job market is being forewarned, which of course, as we know, is forearmed. And one of the best ways to do that is to subscribe to the International Forecaster with all of its incredible information packed in twice a week, quite a voluminous amount of material you managed to pack in. So why don't you tell people about the Forecaster and how they can get their hands on a copy?
Well, the forecast is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world. Published now, I think it's maybe even 24 years now. No, in June it'll be 24 years. And we publish via internet on Wednesdays and Saturdays, runs about 35 to to 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the internet. And everything you need to know each week is in that publication. Free copies. TheInternationalForecaster.com. The International, FORECASTER.com. You can also go to www.INTFORECASTER.com, INTForecaster.com. And for those of you who have questions, and we answer everybody, you email us. You can also get free copies there. And you can also get our latest report on gold and silver shares. And that address is Bob, B-O-B, at INTFORECASTER.com. Bob at INTForecaster.com. And those of you who want to call toll-free, that's 877-479-8178, 877-479-8178. You can get the copies there. And for those of you who want to become subscribers, they have a special deal there for a free one-year subscription. And if you want to be a subscriber, that deal is really terrific. So take advantage of it.
Excellent. Well, on that note, Bob Chapman, it's always a pleasure to have you on. So until next week, thank you and take care.
Well, thank you very much. It's been wonderful being here again.